This particular talk came out of me rereading one of my Dharma books, which is it's always interesting to sort of go back and read something. I mean, this isn't the case of a book I hadn't probably read this particular section of this book for 17, 18 years. I've had this book a long time. And it's a Joseph Goldstein's book, Insight Meditation, and he's talking about what keeps us practicing. Why is it that we just keep practicing? Why do we keep wagging our tails like that? I'm going to read sections of what Joseph said, but intersperse it with other things that I've come across that are related to what Joseph is saying. But let me start with Joseph here. The Buddha taught about four paths or roads to success, to fulfillment, roads that lead us onward. They are four different qualities of character, each reflecting a different strength of personality. So what he's saying is what keeps us going is we have certain predispositions to do this practice, right? If we can recognize which of them is our own particular strength, then we can build on that power we already have. We can do what has to be done. So he's saying this is what will help you keep going, right? Sometimes people have the idea that to practice the Dhamma means to live without passion, without fire, that it means a cool and detached passivity. This is a very mistaken notion. Each of the four roads to power involves a tremendous passion, a great fire within us. For those of us in whom that passion stirs, the Dharma becomes the paramount commitment to our lives. That's an important point, is that part of this reason that we keep practicing is we've made the Dhamma central to our life. It's like this is what underlies our life, what the underlying motivation for things we do and how we act in the world. So the first of these is zeal. Let me read what he has to say first. The first road to success can fuel our commitment is zeal, the strong desire to do, to accomplish something. I actually looked up zeal in the dictionary. And the definition I came across is great energy or enthusiasm in pursuit of a cause or an objective. Great energy or enthusiasm, right? When we feel this quality, we sense that nothing can finally impede us. We feel that we will not be satisfied until we realize our goal. Sometimes when I think of this quality, I think of the extraordinary enthusiasm and motivation of Olympic athletes or great musicians or anyone who has brought something to perfection. The quality of zeal, of ardency, carries them through their lives. I'm going to do this, I'm going to accomplish this. And they do, based on that strength of mind, that unwavering sense of purpose. So, desire to do, a powerful aspiration and motivation, is one of the four roads to success. So let's look at this. This is like I thought of, that book, the children's book called The Little Engine That Could. I think I can, I think I can, I think I. It's like it keeps us, we just keep going because we have this energy that we want to do it, right? However, the word zeal, first of all, it's kind of old-fashioned, and second, when I saw the word zeal, I re immediately thought of the word zealot. Which is from the same root, right? And as someone who's a zealot can be overly zealous, I suppose. It's someone who, what makes me nervous being around. People who are zealots, it's and we have to sort of find that balance. Being overly zealous can lead to a lot of sort of overstriving, but also sort of this sense of, I'm so zealous. I'm the best one here in the whole room. I practice better than anybody else in this Dharma hall. That sort of thinking can arise if we're not careful, and so you have to be aware of this. Joseph Goldstein tells this great story about very his early career as a Dharma student. He's practicing in India, and there's it's a very simple setup, so people don't have separate rooms. So there's a men's dorm and a women's dorm, and each the men's dorm just has little partitions along the wall. So there's no door and there's no roof, and there's just a walkway up and down. So it's sort of quite open, right? So Joseph, being overly zealous, decides that at night he's going to be the last person to go to sleep. He's not going to let anyone else be more zealous than him, right? So he's sitting there and he's practicing and he's studying and whatever. And down the row, about three or four people down the row, there's this other guy whose light's still on. So it's just him and this other guy, because they each have their own little light. And no matter what he does, he can't stay up any as late as that other guy. He keeps, eventually having to, that's it, I can't keep my eyes open. I'm falling asleep trying to practice. He goes to sleep. So at the end of the retreat, he talking. He finds out who this guy is down there who had always had the, so I was staying up later than him. And he's saying, no matter what I could do, I couldn't stay. I really admire you. No matter what I could do, I couldn't stay up as late as you and practice as diligently as you were practicing. And the guy says, sort of looks at him kind of funny, and says, I wasn't staying up late. I was just sleeping with the light on. Yeah, and that's like, oh, oops. But it's like how we get caught, into thinking we're going to be the best, and it just leads us into that sort of foolishness if we're not careful. There is also something. This I found this in the sutta. This is in the Majjhima Nikaya, and this is a sort of an interesting teaching. This is someone who's come to the Buddha to ask him about what motivates him to practice. How do I keep going? It's literally this question I'm asking here. I want to read a section of this. In that way, Master Gotama, there is the final arrival at truth. In that way, one finally arrives at truth. In that way, we can recognize the final arrival at truth. But what, Master Gotama, is most helpful for the final arrival at truth? We ask Master Gotama about the most helpful thing for the final arrival at truth. Striving is the most helpful for the final arrival at truth. That's what the Buddha says. If one does not strive, one will not arrive at the truth. Because one strives, one does finally arrive at the truth. That is why striving is the most helpful for the arrival at truth. But what, Master Gotama, is the most helpful for striving? Scrutiny is the most helpful for striving. If one does not scrutinize, one will not strive. Because one scrutinizes, one looks at things and tries to understand them. That is why scrutiny is most helpful for striving. But what, Master Gotama, is most helpful for scrutiny? I never I gives up. It's one of these classic things. Application of the will is most helpful for scrutiny. If one does not apply one's will not scrutinize. Because one applies one's will, one scrutinizes. That is why application of the will is most helpful for scrutiny. But what, Master Gotama, is the most helpful for application of will? Zeal is the most helpful for the application of will. If one does not arouse zeal, one will not apply one's will. Because one arouses zeal, one applies one's will. That is why Zeal is the most helpful for the application of will. So it all came down to zeal. It's like that zeal, that initial powerful energy to accomplish something. That's what makes everything else flow along. At least in this case, right? So that's the first of these four. Then we come to the second of these four that Joseph is talking about. The second road is the quality of energy. A person who has this resolute determination of heart feels challenged by the thought, "This undertaking requires great effort. I can do it." Such a person not only remains undaunted by the effort required, but also finds inspiration in the challenge. It is the sense, "Whatever can be accomplished by effort, that I can do." So effort. Now this is the word effort here is the translation of the Pali word virya, often also sometimes translated as energy. And in the Buddhist teachings, this is a recurring theme, and a very important aspect. You find it not only, as he's talking about it here, but you see it in the Eightfold Path, right? Number six on the Eightfold Path, effort, energy, virya. It's the third of the seven factors of awakening. It's in the list of the 10 paramis. So it's like, it's one of those things that keeps appearing in different lists all over the place. So obviously, it's an important concept that we have to understand when it comes to the Buddhist teachings. And basically, what energy is all about, from one aspect at least, it's recognizing what is wholesome and steering away from it, and recognizing what is wholesome and cultivating it. So know what's unwholesome, go in that direction. Know what's wholesome, do something about it, right? Keep going there. And the classic teachings on the four aspects of right effort. Basically, the first two are, if you see that this isn't wholesome, well, then steer away. Literally, that's what I'll, sum it up in a few words. And if you see something that's wholesome, then do whatever you can to cultivate it. And if you're in a wholesome mind state, make sure you do whatever you can to maintain it and grow it. Excuse me for a second So, but let's see what this is Joseph again. And he's talking about this idea. He's actually talking about this idea of right effort. This aspect of right effort points to the fundamental understanding of how our mind works. In the suttas, the most pragmatic descriptions of nibbana, liberation, in the mind is a mind that is free from the root defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion. We've all experienced many wholesome mind moments when these defilements are not present, yet have also had unwholesome factors frequently reemerge as conditions change. This is the functioning of what are called latent defilements. Mind states that are not present in the moment, but have the potential to arise whenever the conditions for them to reappear are present. So he's saying, we have to be careful. We think, oh, well, I've got rid of that one now. I'm no longer caught by that one. And that's like, yeah, maybe now you are, maybe in this moment, in this time, in this period in your life. But this idea of a latent defilement, given the right causes and conditions, that whole thing can just come right back at you again. It is just this understanding that conspire a feeling of spiritual urgency when we're leading basically good and wholesome lives. It's easy to become complacent about our present circumstances. But under these favorable conditions, we still have many moments where when greed, hatred or delusion arises. We see something beautiful and we want it. Our mind is pulled toward it. Perhaps we see somebody doing something we don't like, and the mind is suddenly filled with judgment and aversion. We may be tired, and the mind simply dulls out in delusion. So the first of the great endeavors is recognizing that enduring power of these latent defilements, understanding what gives rise to them, and preventing them from arising to take hold. That's a pretty good definition of right effort when it comes to unwholesome mind states. In fact, I'll read that again. So the first of the four great endeavors is recognizing the enduring power of these latent defilements, understanding what gives rise to them, and preventing them from arising and taking hold. It's something we have to sort of, so this is a conscious practice of seeing, oh, I know where this goes. You know, just in, both in our daily life and in our practice, our sitting and walking practice, our formal practice. We know, we see something, we go, I don't need to go there. I don't have any need to go there. And shift things so that we don't. Making conscious choice. It's part of having this idea of effort be manifest in your life. And I also actually, sometimes I can explain things best with a piece of poetry, as you know. This is from Dana Fald's book, because what we also have to watch for, both with zeal and with effort, I think, is we can get caught in judging ourselves. Oh, I just never have, I've never bothered to pay enough attention to this. I've never put enough effort into this. But I don't have that zeal. Everybody's talking about zeal, 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 and I don't get it. I just, you know, we're very careful to, if we're not careful, we start judging ourselves about all of these things. And I think this little poem sort of talks about this quite nicely. It's called Foundation Stones. Here's my past, what I'm proud of and what I've pushed away. Today I see how each piece was needed, not a single step wasted on the way. Like a stone wall, every rock resting on what came before. No stone can be suspended in midair. Foundation laid by every act and omission, each decision, even those the mind would label big mistake. Things I thought were sins, these are as necessary as successes, each one resting on the surface of the last, stone upon stone, the fit particular complete, the rough uneven faces of those rocks, making surprising, satisfying patterns in the sunlight. So we have to understand, we have to be able to look and go, my life hasn't been perfect, and that's okay. I haven't always been super zealous. I haven't always put as much effort as maybe I could have, but that's okay, because I see, I have an understanding of what's required, and I can always choose to do more. So it's not like the end of the, you know, I haven't been zealous enough, so I may as well stop now. We have to be careful of going to those sorts of mental places. Back to Joseph here. The third road to success is strong love for the Dharma, the love for the truth that keeps our mind continually absorbed in the practice. This love has great purity of consciousness and is extremely ardent. When you first fall in love, in the ordinarily worldly sense, your mind fills with thoughts of your beloved. Love for the Dharma has the same, that level of intensity. It becomes a path to understanding when it fills our minds. We continue to reflect on the Dharma, practice it. Nothing else seems equally important. Such love for the Dharma keeps us going. It is our highest love, our highest value. I find this is like, yeah. Do you love the Dhamma? Well, it's an interesting thought. And what does it mean? What does that even mean to what does it mean to love the Dhamma? I mean, it's an interesting question. I want to read something else from Joseph here. No, actually, getting ahead of myself. This is something else from the Majjhima Nikaya, and this is just want to, this is like the last sentence of verse 9 of this particular sutta. This is a sutta where the Buddha is talking to three bhikkhus who live in isolation, but they live together and they help each other out and keep going. And they're talking about all the things they do, like the mundane things they do, how they empty the wastebasket and they don't have to take turns and they use hand signals, they don't have to speak. I mean, it's like an interesting sort of story about what it was like to live in a serious way in following the Buddha's teachings. But then at the end of all his description of these sort of mundane things, they say this: but every 5 days we sit together all night discussing the Dhamma. So these guys, they're in silence the rest of the time. They really try, do everything they can to maintain silence and live a very simple life. But every 5 days they stay up all night discussing the Dhamma. This is love of the Dhamma. It's like, it's like, let's stay up all night and talk about the Dhamma, boys, again, after we haven't done it for 3 or 4 nights now. It's like it has a certain flavor to it that just that sentence strikes me. That is, and he says, that is how we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute, because they love the Dhamma so much. But here's another aspect of this. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya. Another thing I came across. And this is a story about the Buddha very soon after he's enlightened, and he's sort of in that period where he's wandering, trying to figure out, well, what the heck do I do now? And he's He, this is what it says. Then it occurred to the Blessed One, it would be for the sake of fulfilling an unfulfilled virtue that I would honor, respect, and dwell in dependence on another ascetic or Brahmin. So he's like, it would be really good for me to have a teacher. Then he says, however, in this world, with its devas, Mara, and Brahma, in this generation, with its ascetics and Brahmins, its devas and humans, I do not see another ascetic or Brahmin more perfect in virtue than myself, whom I could honor and respect and dwell in dependence on. But I can't. I don't see anybody out there in my experience of the world who could act as my teacher. And he goes and he sort of goes through several iterations of this period of thought, and he's sort of like stuck, like what do, how, what can I do? What can I do? And he says, in the end, he says, okay, all I can do is let me then honor, respect, and dwell in dependence on this very Dhamma to which I have fully awakened, to this understanding which becomes the teachings. Then this Brahma Sahampati appears from the Brahma world. This is, you see this all the time in the Buddhist, in the suttas. It's like some being from a higher dimension comes and hangs out with the Buddha to talk and teach, and he praises the Buddha for having come to this conclusion. And then in this particular section of the Majjhima of the Samyutta Nikaya, there's a lot of sort of a lot of the translation is very poetic, and actually it's written, some of the translation is written in verse, And this is the verse that I found that just struck me. The Buddhas of the past, the future Buddhas, and he who is the Buddha now, removing the sorrow of many, all have dwelt, will dwell, and dwell, deeply revering the true Dhamma. For the Buddhas, this is a natural law. Therefore, one desiring his own good, aspiring for spiritual greatness, should deeply revere the true Dhamma, recollecting the Buddha's teachings. It's like, yeah, love the Dhamma. Don't, you know, and this is, I find this interesting because this is where, particularly in the Theravada teachings and traditions, there's no idea of a guru. There's no idea of, oh, I have to, you know, praise the teacher and bow down to the teacher and those sorts of ways of interacting that you see in other Eastern disciplines. It's just like, it's all about just the teaching. It's just the teaching. That's what's important. Not, you know, when we take refuge, we take root in the Buddha in the sense of that energy that he says we're all capable of. And then we take refuge in the Dhamma, the actual teachings, and the Sangha, those people we practice with, right? But there's no, in other traditions, in fact, in some Buddhist traditions from later iterations of the Buddhist teachings and translations of them, you see a fourth refuge, which is the Guru. But you don't see that at all in the Theravada world. It's just not encouraged in any way. In fact, at one time early in my career, I was sitting, and I this person I was sitting with, his name was is Howie. And Howie had given this totally amazing Dhamma talk the night before. And then I went in for my practice meeting with him the next morning. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm so happy I finally found a true teacher and blah, blah, blah. And he was like horrified. He's like, no, no, no. Don't go there. Don't think that way. You know, that's not what goes on here. You know, it's, you know, he talked about the concept of, you know, the teachers of being what's called a Kalyanamitta, a spiritual friend, which is very different. It's not like someone to revere. A friend is someone you sort of hang out with and learn from, perhaps. But it isn't in any sense reverential. And I found that really, at the time, shocking, because I'd come into these teachings from a very, very much guru-like world yoga, Advaita Vedanta teacher. And it was like, where reference for the teacher was like right there at the top of the list of things you had to deal with. Which is part of why I never was that good at it, probably. But that's another story. But it's just, I think it's interesting that would be what he's talking about. He's talking about just love the Dhamma. That's what's important. Okay, and finally we come to number four on this list. The last of the roads to success is the quality of inquiry, of investigation. Some people have a strong interest in understanding the deepest and most profound aspects of the teachings. They are not satisfied to know just the surface of things. This kind of mind contemplates the immensity of samsara, this round of rebirths, the immensity of the planes of existence, and the implications in our lives of this vastness of vision. A person with such fervent inquiry investigates and understands the potential for suffering and the possibilities for freedom. Such a person takes the deepest satisfaction in probing and investigating the profound mysteries of consciousness. Sounds like some of you, I suspect. And me, I'll be honest. But I think this is interesting because he's like pointing to this idea that sort of this curiosity, like, what does all this stuff mean? Can I understand this? Can I study it? Can I approach it from this sort of investigative, curious mind and absorb some of it in that way? Joseph talks about that. I just want to read a little section. This is where he's talking about what it is, this practice, one way you can look at this practice. And he calls it understanding the nature of thought. This is like, oh, this is investigating, right? This is like, what's the nature of thought? I mean, how many of us even think about what the nature of thought is, right? But let's see what Joseph has to say here anyway. One of the most freeing aspects of investigating the mind comes from examining our thoughts. Mostly we are lost in the movies of our minds and not even aware of the fact that we're thinking. But as we become more mindful of thought as an object of awareness, we begin to notice that we're thinking, and then on a deeper level, wisdom sees the very ephemeral nature of thought itself. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche points to the freedom that's possible with this understanding. When a rainbow appears, we see many beautiful colors. Yet a rainbow is not something we can close ourselves with or wear as an ornament. It simply appears. And through the conjunction of various conditions, thoughts arise in the mind. It's just the same way. They have no tangible reality or intrinsic existence at all. There's therefore no logical reason why thought should have so much power over us, nor any reason why we should be enslaved by them. Describes how we act sometimes and how we get caught sometimes in these thought storms. I think of them as thought storms sometimes, where it's like you feel enslaved by them. Once you recognize that thoughts are empty, the mind will no longer have the power to deceive us. Just as long as we take our deluded thoughts as real, they will continue to torment us mercilessly, as they have been doing throughout countless past lives. Or countless years in this life, for that matter. Right? And this is like, well, wouldn't that be interesting to sort of notice, be able to, because what Joseph is saying and what the Rinpoche is saying is this is something we can actually realize. It's something we can, it's not like we can intellectually absorb it and go, yeah, that makes sense. But with that intention to look deeply, I like to think of it sometimes as looking underneath the surface. Practice. When we practice, often what we're being aware of is on the surface of our mind. Oh, that itch and that story and blah blah blah. And what am I going to do have for lunch later? And those things we think about, they're all the surface things, and we notice them and we're mindful of them perhaps. But when we start looking deeper underneath, what we see is what he's describing as one of the things we see, that thoughts. That all these thoughts we're having have no solidity at all. And I'm not in any sense claiming that that's my normal day-to-day experience, because it isn't. But it's an interesting idea to sort of, oh, let's see if I can see my thoughts from that angle. Can I look at what's arising in my mind from that particular perspective? And what does that mean? What would that even mean to be able to look at things that are arising in my mind from that perspective? Soon as hay fever season. And our lilac is blooming in the backyard, so anyhow, continuing on with Joseph, because now he's sort of summing this up. Someone endowed with any one of these four bases of power will undoubtedly come to liberation. We may free ourselves through the power of zeal, the great desire and motivation to follow the path. We may do it through the quality of heroic effort, an effort that cannot be stopped. We may come to awakening through our absorption in and love for the Dhamma, or we may experience freedom through the power of investigation. We need to know and understand any one of these can be our path to fulfillment. Any one of these. I think that's really important that we understand. That we somehow, if we're not careful, we think, well, I have to have all those things. I have to be, you know, full of zeal and full of love for the Dhamma and work hard and investigate. And I'm supposed to do all that stuff. And what Joseph is saying, no, no, that's not necessarily true at all. I mean, it may be, maybe you're one of those people who's, that's, you know, that's your nature. But if we look and see which one of these four is our sort of strong suit, then it might be quite useful to sort of put energy in that way into our practice in that direction. Joseph goes on. Our work is to recognize where our strengths lie and to practice from that place of strength and to develop it, to cultivate it, and to make it even stronger. Our great life challenge is to do the work of awakening, to see that the path of practice lies in bringing these liberating qualities of heart and mind to each moment. The path of awakening is moment to moment. It is right here. Can we hold this vision and be complete in our attention to the moment? Can we be deeply inspired by what is true, remembering that our practice is never just for ourselves? We practice for the benefit and welfare of all beings. The Buddha pointed out the four roads to success. The rest is up to us. So I was thinking about all this after I read this and sort of came up with what I wanted to talk about. And I think this is like an addendum to what Joseph had to say. I'm going to be bold and do an addendum to Joseph, which is quite radical, actually. And that's that I think at different times in our practice life, I think of my practice life, different of these qualities have been the one that's been most predominant. When I first encountered this practice, as I mentioned, I practiced in a different form for a long time and was struggling. And then a friend of mine, this is like 22 years ago, 23 years ago, said, you should read this book by Joseph Goldstein called The Experience of Insight. And I read this book and I went, wow, I have to understand this stuff. So that idea of investigating and digging in, that's what got me going. That was my first energy burst. Was like, let's go and see if I can understand what, because the book was saying amazing things, but I didn't really understand most of it. It was like, what's this all about? You know, but it was like, it inspired me. And I went off and, you know, like as soon as I could, like a few months later, actually, I went and sat for 10 days with Joseph and Sharon Salzberg for a 10-day retreat, and I never sat in this form at all. I just went off and jumped in with both feet and sat for 10 days. It was pretty, pretty wild 10 days, the first time I sat for 10 days, having no preparation and never having sat in this tradition at all. I just read this book. But it was good because I started to actually, that investigation energy became quite predominant for a while. But then over time, I've shifted quite strongly, I think, to the love for the Dhamma energy, that way of emphasizing my practice, putting the energy of my practice into, you know, studying the Dhamma, which is a way of expressing love for the Dhamma. That's what motivates me more than anything else. That's what keeps me going. I keep, you know, reading and rereading things and finding things in the teachings in the sutta, going, wow, yeah. And it just sort of warms my heart. Not to say I haven't at times had been very diligent and effort, and even probably a little zealous sometimes. Though Zeal is the probably of the four, the one that least moves me. I've never been that's not my personality. I'm sort of more your slow but sure kind of guy, and the effort kind of guy, if anything. And fine, but you can sort of see how different times in your practice when you start to look at your practice life as a whole, and even like maybe even day to day. I think that's also true. Like some mornings you wake up, oh, I'm gonna sit for an hour this morning because I really am. You just feel full of beans and energy. Other days it's like, I've been having, I'm sort of really grumpy and confused this morning, but I'm gonna sit and let's sort of investigate what it's like to sit when I'm grumpy. And sort of that's that investigative energy is sort of now there. Like, and you start to sort of see different of these qualities because we, I think in the end, all of these qualities are in all of us who take this practice seriously, but one of them predominates. And I guess what I'm pointing to is that at certain times in our practice, one of these may be more predominant. And as Joseph says, maybe one of these is where we put our most of our energy. We put a, let's use this character trait, this personality thing that I have. And use that to keep me going all the time. And understanding what that is helps you steer towards how you form your practice and what you do with your practice time. One more piece of poetry, of course. This is Dana Faulds again. This is called Setting Forth. Something will be born from this goodbye. In the pain of setting forth, something will die. With the release of the old comes a moment when nothing is firmly held, and the unknown burns the bridges of the past. When the smoke clears, my eyes seek out the new horizon. Nothing is known here, but the air is sweet, and breathing deeply, I can see long dormant seeds send up their shoots from the fertile ground of change. As leaves unfurl to meet the sun, the circle is complete. I will not forget a single step of this sacred journey, nor will I let comfort lock me in its warm embrace. I do not know what fruits these seeds will bear, but I have faith that what is taking root today will surprise me with its vigor. In birth and death, the in-breath and the final exhalation, there is pain and movement into truth. I take the step that I am called to, even if I do not know the final destination. I think that's a very important last sentence there. I take the step that I am called to, even if I do not know the final destination. That's something we also have to acknowledge. We all have this idea. Oh, it's all about enlightenment, right? Who knows what that is? We have faith that it's something that is worth working towards. It's faith. We have faith that we need to be zealous, or we need to put in lots of effort, or we need to have love for the Dhamma. We need to investigate, be curious. But that's all we have. We don't really know what that is. At least I should say I don't know. Let's be, who knows? So that's all I have to say. So I'm going to turn off.